Today is Tuesday, February 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. and Russian diplomats clash at a U.N. Security Council meeting on Ukraine.
It was not unexpected, the reactions of the U.S. and the Russian envoys to each other. I mean, we saw this in 2014, certainly. We had like 30 meetings on Ukraine.
U.S. senators are close to a deal to sanction Russia over its actions regarding Ukraine.
Senators Bob Menendez, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and James Risch, the committee's top Republican, said they hope to move forward on the bill this week.
And Pakistan braces for more attacks as militants kill 10 security officials. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russia has accused the West of, quote, whipping up tensions, unquote, over Ukraine, and says the U.S. has brought what it calls, quote, pure Nazi, unquote, to power in Kyiv. This as the U.S. Security Council held a stormy and bellicose debate Monday on Moscow's troop buildup near its southern neighbor. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield shot back that Russia's growing military force of more than 100,000 troops along Ukraine's borders was, quote, the largest mobilization, unquote, in Europe in decades. The harsh exchanges in the Security Council came as Moscow lost an attempt to block the meeting and reflected the gulf between the two nuclear powers. It was the first open session where our protagonists in the Ukraine crisis spoke publicly, even though the UN's most powerful body took no action. For more, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir.
It was not unexpected, the reactions of the U.S. and the Russian envoys to each other. I mean, we saw this in 2014, certainly. We had like 30 meetings on Ukraine after the invasion of the Crimea back then. And this is sort of the same scenario. Adversaries in a public place, each one saying the other one is wrong. And the U.S. basically demanded from Russia that they should explain themselves why they're amassing 100,000 or more troops on their borders with Ukraine. And the Russians said, you guys are being hysterical, basically. We move troops around all the time, many times, and nobody got so upset. So what are you giving us a hard time about? Why are we even having this meeting? And in fact, the Russians tried to stop the meeting going ahead. They used a procedural technicality to try and stop it, a procedural vote. They needed 9 countries to support their call to not to have the meeting, and they didn't get that. So the meeting went ahead in public, but they said, we're not afraid to discuss this. We just don't think it's necessary.
Was anything agreed on?
The sides, the stakeholders, to put their positions out there in a public forum, because as the U.S. pointed out, there's been about 100 engagements and meetings in the last weeks on this issue. They've all been private meetings in different formulations, and they felt it's time there's a public meeting as part of preventative diplomacy. And at this meeting, we also heard from the Ukrainian envoy, because after all, it is his country that's hanging in the balance here. And he said that if Russia has any questions for Ukraine, they should meet them and talk with them, and that President Zelensky of Ukraine is willing to meet with President Putin. And he said it would be a much better thing to do than to bring your troops to our borders and to intimidate our people. But he did tell reporters after the meeting that he believes a Russian invasion could be, in his words, imminent. And when he was asked to explain more precisely what he meant by imminent, you know, because that could be days, weeks, months, hours, whatever. He pulled out a dictionary of Russian and English diplomacy, and he read to the reporters from this diary, from this dictionary, and he said that the meaning of imminent means approaching, hanging over, and then only unavoidable. And so he said we have to work very hard so that it remains only approaching and hanging over and not becomes unavoidable.
Are more meetings scheduled, or this is it?
This was a one-off, but I imagine there's going to be, this will, you know, continue to raise itself on the agenda if things don't cool off, if the two sides don't de-escalate. But there is a meeting. The Russians are going to assume the presidency of the UN Security Council on Tuesday for the month of February. It's an alphabetical order. Each member of the Security Council takes a turn being president, and it just happens that February is the Russian month. And they have a meeting planned for the 17th of February on the Minsk Accord, the Minsk agreements, and that's been part of the whole Ukraine mediation since 2014. And this is a regular meeting of the Minsk format. And so we will definitely be hearing more on the 17th. There's also a meeting planned in the UN General Assembly for the 23rd of February. And that's also sort of an annual event that has to do with the annexation of Crimea, where states kind of reaffirm that that's illegal and they don't recognize it because Crimea annexed part of Ukraine in 2014 when they invaded previously.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. Two leading U.S. senators on Sunday said they are very close to reaching a deal on legislation to sanction Russia by its actions regarding Ukraine, including some measures that may take effect before any invasion. Tamara Lindstrom of Reuters produced this report.
Senators Bob Menendez, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and James Risch, the committee's top Republican, said they hope to move forward on the bill this week. Menendez added that there is strong bipartisan resolve to support Ukraine and punish Russia if it invades. Russia has been building up its forces on Ukraine's borders for months and has demanded NATO pull troops and weapons from Eastern Europe and bar Ukraine from ever joining the U.S.-led military alliance. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky supports immediate action and has criticized the West for waiting to impose more damaging sanctions. The U.S. Senate bill would target the most significant Russian banks and Russian sovereign debt, as well as provide more U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. Menendez said that some of the sanctions could take effect before any invasion by Russia because of what Moscow has already done, including cyber attacks on Ukraine and efforts to undermine the Ukrainian government internally. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Sunday tweeted that the situation is increasingly concerning and urged Russia to engage in negotiations. Johnson said he has ordered British armed forces to prepare to deploy across Europe next week to support NATO allies. The prime minister is also due to visit the region this week and will speak by phone to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
That's Tamara Lindstrom of Reuters. For the last 8 years, Ukraine has lived under a permanent state of alert with the constant threat of Russia's intervention in its territory. The fear and tensions have led many civilians to seek military training to be prepared in the event of a conflict. Jonathan Speer narrates this report for VOA from Ricardo Makina in Kyiv.
On the outskirts of Kiev, a group of about 200 men and women receive military training. They are civilians who have joined the Territorial Defense Force, a reserve corps set up by authorities to support the Ukrainian armed forces in the event of a conflict. They train on their own time and they buy their own weapons. Volunteers spoke on condition of not giving their full names. This man, identified only as Yuri, gives a simple reason for joining. I'm here to learn fighting techniques and support the army to defend Ukraine. Russian military pressure on Ukraine, with a massive deployment not far from its eastern border, has once again raised the specter of war. For many here, the question is not whether there will be a war, but when. Denis Semidog-Orlik serves as Deputy Chief Coordinator of the Reservist Council of the 112th Territorial Defense Brigade. Putin believes there is no country called Ukraine and that he has to take it under his control. Since he could not do it by changing his government from within him, he only has one option left, the military path. After more weeks of intense media reporting on a possible conflict, those in charge of these exercises want to reduce tensions among the Ukrainian population and are urging calm, including among these trainees. Keep calm is the order that drill instructors like Ertem Sokhan, a veteran of the Ukrainian army, are receiving. Our commanders tell us, clean the gun, get ready, and don't panic. That is the Ukrainian way. The following workday, these men and women will return to their jobs in the city, while in Moscow and Washington, the political tug of war that could push them to war will continue. For Ricardo Marquina in Kiev, John Speer, VOA News.
With Russian forces poised to attack Ukraine, Turkish-made drones are set to face a big test in battle as well as a challenge to Turkish relations with Russia. Despite warnings from Russia, Turkish firms have continued to supply Kyiv with armed drones, which have proved decisive in recent conflicts. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
As Russia builds up its forces near the Ukrainian border, Turkey is continuing to supply Ukraine with newly developed armed drones. Asla Aydintashbash, a senior fellow at the European Council, points to growing strains in Ankara's relations with Moscow.
Turkey is not happy about Russian expansion. Turkey is not happy that Russia is flexing its muscles in the former Soviet space. And it's particularly been supportive of Ukraine by way of selling weapons, but also drones.
From Libya to Syria, Turkish drones, or unmanned air vehicles, also known as UAVs, have quickly gained a reputation as being cheap and effective. The drones drew world attention in 2020 after playing a key role in Azerbaijan's defeat of Armenian-backed forces in the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. But in Ukraine, they would face a far more formidable challenge from Russian forces. That is the view of defense analyst Ardar Mevlutoglu.
In conflicts such as Syria, Libya, and Nagorno-Karabakh, Turkish drones were used against air defenses of low quality or virtually no air defenses at all. However, Russian army possesses a large number of sophisticated air defense equipment, electronic warfare equipment.
In October, the Ukrainian army's use of Turkish drones against Russian-backed separatists underscored, some analysts say, the drones' importance not only militarily, but psychologically. Petro Bokovsky is a senior fellow at the Democratic Initiatives Foundation in Kiev.
That increased morale not only in the Ukrainian army, but also in the general public, and showed that, yes, Ukrainians can resist, can defend themselves from Russian invasion in Donbas. And that also made Turkey more visible as an ally.
Russia was quick to condemn Ukraine's use of Turkish drones. The Turkish and Russian presidents have developed strong ties, raising concerns at NATO. Turkey is heavily dependent on Russian gas and cooperation in Syria. But if Turkish-made drones end up causing Russian casualties, bilateral ties could face a big challenge. Mustafa Aydin is a professor of international relations at Kadahas University in Istanbul.
Turkish ammunitions and also UAVs would be used by the Ukrainian side, and that would be not very acceptable for the Russians. If Turkey pushed for a choice, Turkey would choose the Western alliance and NATO. But it's very difficult to predict whether the Ukraine is that eventuality.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is due to visit Kiev this week in a bid to mediate between Ukraine and Russia, hoping that averting confrontation will avoid a difficult choice for Turkey. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Pakistan has placed its security forces on high alert and is bracing for more attacks as militant groups extend their reach and scale of activities. This after military officials said the heavily armed militants attacked a security post in a remote area of southwest Pakistan, triggering a firefight that killed 10 soldiers and an assailant. The attack occurred in Kerch, a remote mountainous district of southwestern Balochistan, a natural gas and mineral-rich province. For more on investigations launched by the authorities, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gar.
Well, this is a separatist ethnic Baloch militant organization called Balochistan Liberation Front, which has claimed responsibility for this attack on a mountaintop security post of Pakistani military. And this is just a Pakistani area in the Balochistan province, which is next to the border with Iran. And that's the area where this separatist militant group is quite active. This was quite a daring attack against the military because obviously there were like 40 to 45 Baloch militants who surrounded this security post and assaulted and killed all the soldiers there and then set it on fire. That was a very strong message for the military in that area. Like at least in 3 or 4 years that this was the deadliest attack that the Pakistan army suffered. It's not just one attack. We have seen a series of attacks carried out by several Baloch militant groups who are fighting for the independence of this Pakistani province. Baloch Balochistan, which borders Afghanistan as well as Iran.
What is the government doing about this?
There are certain areas where security forces are conducting operations, and we also see that these militant groups, whether they are the Pakistani Taliban or Baloch militants, that they have claimed responsibility for these attacks. But so far, they have not come out with any significant announcement about whether they have been able to track down these assailants. Usual statements by the government we have seen. But the most significant action that the government has taken, that over the weekend, a high-level delegation led by Pakistan's National Security Advisor traveled to Afghanistan and held talks with new Taliban authorities in the neighboring country. And one of the topics in this discussion, we know from our sources, was to press the Afghan Taliban to evict or contain the activities of the Pakistani Taliban, because main leaders of Pakistani Taliban are actually located in Afghanistan, and Pakistani officials have repeatedly said that they are orchestrating attacks against Pakistan from their sanctuaries on the Afghan side of the border. So these discussions over the weekend, two-day discussions, focused on the security issues that are causing problems for Pakistan. And according to Pakistani officials, these are the Pakistani Taliban who are coming from across the border and launching these attacks. So that high-profile visit ended yesterday, and we saw a statement from the government. But whether the Pakistani delegation was able to secure any guarantees from the Afghan Taliban to deal with these militants, we don't know for sure, because we also know that the Afghan Taliban are really obliged to the Pakistani Taliban, because both fought over the last 20 years against American and international forces based in Afghanistan. So it's very difficult for the Afghan Taliban to evict the Pakistani Taliban, although the Afghan Taliban have promised the international community and neighboring countries that now that they are in control, they will try to fight effectively any terrorist group operating on the Afghan soil. But we don't know exactly whether the Afghan Taliban have given any assurances to the Pakistani delegates.
And what kind of measures are in place by the Pakistani authorities to prevent a reoccurrence, or at least to mitigate some of this rash of attacks?
We have seen that they have increased deployment of paramilitary forces in cities which are next to the border with Afghanistan. And there is also heavy police deployment in sensitive areas. But still today, even we saw that in a couple of northwestern areas which are not far from the Afghan border, there were targeted attacks against police officials. And today, once again, two police officers were killed. And we also know that yesterday in the same region, the city of Peshawar, which is the capital of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, one Christian priest was assassinated and another was wounded in a gun attack just after these two priests were coming out of the church in Peshawar. They were ambushed.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. In other news, the Biden administration is slapping sanctions on top members of Myanmar's judiciary and one of its main revenue-producing courts over rights abuses since last year's coup. The sanctions on the country's Attorney General, Supreme Court Chief Justice, and others were announced by the Treasury and State Department to coincide with the one-year anniversary of the February 2021 coup, which replaced the civilian-led government with a military regime. The penalties freeze any assets that those targeted may have in the U.S. jurisdiction and bar Americans from doing business with them. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedofo in Washington. The Australian Air Force is preparing to deliver 20 tons of emergency supplies to remote communities cut off by flood waters. Traffic has been disrupted on the main highway and a railway between Adelaide in South Australia and Darwin, the capital city of the Northern Territory. From Sydney, Phil Musser reports.
Heavy rain and storms in recent days have damaged freight routes in South Australia. A 14-day major emergency was declared Friday by state authorities. It gives the police special powers to ensure food reaches isolated communities. South Australia has a population of 1.7 million who are already under a major emergency declaration for COVID-19. The state was also badly impacted by the Black Summer bushfires of 2019-20, although the floods have occurred away from the areas worst hit by the fires. The area is expected to receive yet more rain, with up to 200 millimetres forecast in the coming days. A military plane is scheduled to land Monday in the outback settlement of Kuba Pedi to deliver food and other essentials. The town is 850 kilometres north of Adelaide on the Stuart Highway and is known as the opal capital of the world because of its mining resources. The impact on mining and farming might not be known for days. Tim Jackson, the administrator of the Kuba Pedi Council, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the arrival of supplies would ease community concerns.
People are pretty relaxed, generally speaking, I think, and particularly now that they know that there's a significant food drop being made today. It's just a bit frustrating. It's just the unknown about when the highway is going to be opened again. I understand that it's the first time both the rail and the road have been impacted simultaneously.
Flooding in South Australia and the disruption to freight routes have led to shortages on supermarket shelves in the Northern Territory and Western Australia. Higher than average rainfall this summer is associated with a La Niña weather system, which can also produce a higher than normal number of tropical cyclones. The naturally occurring system develops when strong winds move the warm surface waters of the Pacific Ocean from South America towards Indonesia. In Australia, the La Niña system increases the likelihood of cooler daytime temperatures, reducing the risk of bushfires and heat waves. Conservationists are warning that the impact of climate change will increase the incidence and intensity of extreme rainfall events in Australia. They've said that the risks of flooding are exacerbated when the atmosphere is made warmer and wetter by climate change. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Rescue efforts continue across southeastern Africa Monday for thousands of people cut up by flooding from last week's tropical storm Ana. The storm killed at least 90 people across Madagascar, Mozambique and Malawi. Experts say a fresh cyclone forming near the island nation of Mauritius could hamper rescue efforts and worsen damage in the region. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The storm damaged public infrastructures, including healthcare facilities and roads, and interrupted healthcare delivery to people affected by the storm. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the storm killed 20 people in Mozambique and displaced 121,000 others. In Madagascar, according to the Africa CDC, 48 people were killed and 148,000 others left homeless. In Malawi, the Department of Disaster Management Affairs says Tropical Storm Ana killed 32 people and displaced 188,000 from their homes across 17 districts. Chibiriro Kamula is the department spokesperson.
For Chikwawa alone, a total of 44 camps have been set to accommodate the displaced. But the figures might rise because the council is still conducting some assessment, and the general public will be updated on any developments.
On Thursday, President Lazarus Chakwera declared a national disaster in areas hard hit by Tropical Storm Ana and called for urgent assistance to the flood victims. In a statement Sunday, the Department of Disaster Management said relief assistance is reaching some areas, although efforts to access others are hampered by impassable roads. The countries affected by Tropical Storm Ana are concerned by reports of a fresh tropical cyclone known as Batsirai is forming near the island nation of Mauritius. However, weather experts in the region have downplayed those fears. Yob Kachiwanda is the spokesperson for the Malawi's Department of Meteorological Services. He says tropical cyclone Batsirai is currently still in the Indian Ocean, east of Madagascar.
And at this stage, of course, the track is not very certain. So more of its possible track will be determined in the next few days. But otherwise, for now, no threat to my weather. But it is there be any pause of threat to my weather, the Malawi and Wakefi from the continent.
If it does approach Malawi, he advises people in flood-prone areas to take heed of any warnings from weather experts and officials.
If they are saying put high ground, they should act immediately because these threats are there as climate change is with us.
President Chakwera offered similar advice Monday when he visited flood victims in the Chikwawa and Insanje districts in southern Malawi. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Mali has long been known for its music, dance and cultural festivals despite an ongoing insurgency that has halted most tourism. Two military coups since 2020 and delayed elections led African nations to impose economic sanctions against Mali, which Europe has supported. But as the festival season kicks off, participants and organizers are still finding reasons to sing and dance. Anna Risenberg reports for Bamako, Mali.
Veronique Janan Lou is an interpretive dancer from Ivory Coast living in Niger. Lou was invited to Mali's Fardi Foni Wati dance festival this year, arriving by bus on January 9th. That same day, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, imposed travel and economic sanctions on Mali, closing land and air borders between Mali and its West African neighbors. Lou is unsure of how exactly she will get home to Niger. In the meantime, she performed as part of a group dance piece in an auditorium at the Blomba Cultural Center, packed with adults and neighborhood children alike. She says she found a festive atmosphere in the country, despite the sanctions. People aren't even worried about that, she says. The government, they work for themselves, and we the artists, we are doing our thing. We are just one voice. We're the voice of the people. We don't know when all of these problems will be solved, so we are doing our activities and we continue our party. Before the 2012 takeover of northern Mali by Islamist militants, the country was known for its cultural festivals, which were a frequent attraction for tourists. But these festivals have always been popular with Malians, and even though tourism has nearly ground to a halt, the festivals have, for the most part, continued. New festivals have popped up in the years since unrest began. The Ogabanya Festival is a week-long Dogon cultural festival held on the Niger riverbank in Bamako in its seventh year. Amasago Dunyon is the president of the organizing committee of the festival, which he hopes can be a place for people to unwind. There has been this embargo, he says. There has been worry of what will we do tomorrow. Culture is a neutral means of expression. No one is afraid to come here because it's a place of culture, a place of exchange, a place of dialogue. And this is the best kind of place for people to gather, to talk, and to de-stress. The Fardi Foni Wati Festival depends on participants who come from other countries in the West African region, as well as Europe, to perform original dance pieces alongside Malian performers. Drissa Samake, the managing director of the Blomba Center, says that even though many participants could not make it to Bamako this year because of the travel embargo, calling off the festival was never an option. He says that it's during times when the country is facing crises that it's even more important to hold these cultural activities.
Aucune action ne peut réunir autant de monde.
He says, nothing can unite so many people during this period, like these cultural events. It's important to us to strengthen this sector that allows us to create what we call social cohesion. The festival on the Niger will be held next weekend in Segu, Mali, and Festival Agna in Kolikoro takes place later in February. Both will bring together musicians from around the country. How Mali's current political situation will progress remains to be seen, but music and dancing is sure to continue. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Of America, Washington, ba 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 zip.